Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second of my comedy interviews for my blog, A Rich Comic Life. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome one of my favourite female comedians, Jo Caulfield. Yes! Hello, Jo! How are you? Are you all right?
Enjoying clapping myself, yes. I'm good, yeah.
And how are you doing? Are you okay?
I'm good. I'm sort of the whirlwind that was the sort of last 2 weeks where suddenly there was lots of work.
Yeah.
Because everything that we thought had gone by the wayside in terms of Christmas office dues and stuff, they suddenly realized they could do through Zoom. And so there was lots of gigs, which was great, but in a completely different way. Because I was doing them from home in my spare room, but I was going, okay, I've got one at five, I've got one at six, I'm on there at four. So it was sort of weird and sort of having to remember, and who are these people and whereabouts in the country are they? But it was great. And it was also great because there's an intimacy about the Zoom gigs.
Yeah.
Although you're not in the same room, you're in their house.
Yes, exactly, you know? Yeah.
And there was something nice. You could tell a lot of these people, they'd all been working from home, so they hadn't seen their colleagues. So there was actually a really nice sense of them enjoying seeing their friends and colleagues, also enjoying nosing around their houses, of course, judgments. But, you know, wanting the event to work, whereas often a live Christmas party with a company is people just wanting to talk to each other and getting outrageously drunk. But people behave better in their own homes, strangely.
Well, there you are. That's fantastic. Well, as I say, I'm absolutely delighted you're here. I'm going to chat to you about your career in comedy, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to start off by asking... how and why did you become a comedian in the first place?
I had no idea. It was never cut and dried like that. I was never thinking, I'll become a comedian.
Right.
Wasn't really aware. I was very aware of comedy, but I wasn't aware that that was anything you could aspire to be as a job. And I was sort of drifting around doing different things. I'd done lots of jobs in terms of, like, I'd run a market stall. I was very into 50s clothes and rockabilly. So I was very involved in that scene, and then just waitressing, working in clubs and things. And then comedy was just, it was something I liked, and I watched it with a sort of feeling of, I think I could maybe do this, but it didn't seem doable. It seemed far too hard. Like seeing people's routines on TV, I thought, oh, I could never write these sort of jokes.
Right.
And because I just couldn't understand how you could do that, these very formulated jokes that a lot of the old school comics were. This is like mainstream comics that I was seeing on TV then. And I thought, oh, I don't know how you do that. And then it was when a friend of mine took me to the Comedy Store, and I remember the bill, because the compere was Mark Lamar, who weirdly I knew from the rockabilly circuit, but I didn't know he was a comedian.
Wow.
We were both into the same music. And then Jack D was on, Sean Mio was on, and Mike Haley, who used to do impressions.
Oh, brilliant.
Sean Mio, I thought, was really funny, but that seemed undoable because they seemed very clever, carefully constructed jokes.
Yeah.
But Jack D and Mark Lamar, they seemed just like people talking. That shows how little I knew about it. That I, you know, I just thought they were up there being sarky and moaning about stuff. And that's when something went off in my head and I thought, I think I could do that. They seemed like my mates. I remember that feeling, and I still remember that years on in comedy going, that's what I want people to feel, that I'm just their funny mate in the pub, that we have a connection. And that was what made me think I could do it. And then I did an open spot because a friend had done an open spot and it went really badly.
Right.
But I did work on the material. I didn't quite know what material was, but I knew that you had to think about it, that you couldn't just go up and chat. So I had a routine, which I still remember to this day. I had two routines. And I think this is not a bad way to start, because what I did was I thought, I'll remember anything funny I've said to friends. So one of them was like a story I told a couple of friends, and then it became a bit of a, oh, I've got that funny story, I'll tell these other people this funny story. And that was basically about going on holiday with my parents as a kid and the first time that I saw my dad's balls. That was what the story was, that he had his shorts on and I could see up his leg and I didn't know what these things were. And then I said, and I started flicking, I thought it was some sort of sea urchin. So I started to get rid of them. And then the punchline was, I remember my mum saying, and Joe's ruined the day. I didn't find out why, you know. And then the other routine was about, because I used to wear my hair all sort of piled up in kind of a beehive-y thing. And I used to say, oh, I know it looks like I've got long hair, but I haven't. And again, I had said this. I remember saying it to somebody in a club one night and people were laughing. And I thought, right, store that. Like a sort of sociopath in a way. And I said, oh, so, I don't really have long hair. It's just one really long nipple hair that I pull up and put around my head. And I remember that they were my two routines. And it was a competition night at the Comedy Cafe. And I won the competition.
Wow.
So that night, I remember thinking, oh, I've got this sussed. And of course, I didn't. Of course, it took me years to learn how to do comedy. But I was hooked. I thought that's what I think. I found the thing that I should be doing.
That is amazing, because my home city is Carlisle, but I've been living and working in London for the last 25 years. Mm. And when I first went to the Comedy Store in the 80s, it was a similar build to yours, and I was hooked. Mine was Steve Gribbin, Linda Smith. The compere was Richard Morton. And the top of the bill was somebody called Charles Fleischer, who nobody had ever heard of again, but he went on to voice Roger Rabbit. So it was incredible.
How funny. Yeah. But it's funny, isn't it? How if it gets you, you remember everything about it, don't you?
Yeah. And of course, this is all documented in my blog, because I've seen so many of the comedians over the years. But So you mentioned the gig at the Comedy Cafe. Was that your first ever gig?
Yeah, that was absolutely my first gig. Apart from, I suppose, the one sort of rehearsal in a way I'd had for it was, I went to drama school for a year a terrible drama school, East 15. And I did a postgraduate course, even though I'm not a graduate and I never went to university. But I think I did that because I was older and I thought, I don't want to spend 3 years doing anything.
No.
So I did that. And one of the exercises was to do 5 minutes of stand-up. And stand-up seemed sort of quite a new thing then. Wow. And that's when the friend from drama school went to the club and did it, went to the Comedy Store and I went with them. But I thought, oh, I'm not doing it in front of anyone I know. I'm going to wait. So I waited to do the gig, but I had to do the exercise in class. And people just kind of, it's funny, isn't it? I remember people just standing up and like talking or telling funny or reading jokes from a book or things like that. That's how they did it. But I thought about it and let it go by a couple of weeks before I thought, no, I'm ready. I've got my stories. And when I did it, I have to say mine was the best. Because I'd worked on it, whereas everybody else didn't really take it seriously and wasn't interested in it as I was.
Yeah.
But already that first thing had lit something in me where I thought, oh, hang on, I think I might be able to do this.
And there you go. It's fantastic. It's funny because nowadays, most recently, a friend of mine who wanted to be a stand-up comedian went on a course, and you need a friend to come along with you to sit and watch your performances. That was the rule. And he ended up asking me, because I've got such a loud, distinctive laugh, to go along and see him. And I must have seen this act, this 5-minute act, for about 20 times in a row. And it just got monotonous. And I thought, you're very good. You've won. You're very good at this. And he's doing really well. But it's a daunting thing, because you walk out onto the stage and you have to get them straight away. And that must be very challenging, and obviously gained with experience, I would imagine.
Yeah, and also what comes with experience of if you don't get them straight away, because I felt that on stage. Sometimes you go on, you go, oh, you don't like me, or you don't think I'm going to be any good. Sometimes people make a judgment from looking at you, and I go, oh, so you think I'm going to be shit, and then I just sort of, I've done it enough to know if I just stand my ground, do my stuff, then they change their mind and it works, you know. But it does take a long time. It took me a long time to become confident, and people would talk about being confident, and I couldn't imagine being confident.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think it's good, because sometimes I think I see people with a lot of confidence on stage, and I think sometimes that confidence will be your undoing. If you're too confident too early, you don't work on it enough. Because it's easy for you. Mm. So I always think it's great to really work and have the best material and then become confident and become a good performer, because then you've got both, you know.
Having seen so many, I totally agree, because it's so... I'm in a very lucky position to have seen so many great comedians blossom each time I see them, and you can see the confidence growing in them. It's extraordinary. And you're a classic example of that, because I first saw you way back in 2007 in Edinburgh, and you were very good then. But then, of course, recently at Always Be Comedy and on the Royal Variety that you've just done, fantastic, effortless, really, really good. You know, so it's joyous to see. What do you normally, are there any particular subjects you concentrate on when you're on stage? Do you like to talk about certain things, or?
If people were to describe me, it would be observational.
Yeah.
But I think I'm observational. I'm someone who observes and then gets angry about what I've observed.
Perfect.
I'm not like nice observational, like, oh, isn't it funny when we do this? I'm like, isn't that fucking annoying? I saw this woman do this. How fucking stupid is that? So it's that combination. And I find that release of anger joyous.
Yeah.
I actually think, weirdly, I think I'm a really positive person because I am letting it out. I am not letting life drag me down,
I think people feel that. Yeah,
you know, that they're going, oh, she doesn't give a fuck. That's great. We should be more like that, you know, not bow down to authority. And I'm very, in a weird way, anti entertainment.
Yes, yeah.
That's why I think there's a difference in entertainment is forelock tugging.
Yeah,
you know. Whereas I noticed this. The first person I saw who had this was Dave Allen, who my parents used to watch, and he talks to you like an equal. He wasn't a forelock tugging entertainer, like, oh, I hope you people like this. He was just, I always felt like he was just telling you what he's been doing.
Yeah.
And it was almost like when the show ended, it would be your turn in the conversation, you know, and he'd be like, so what's been going on with you? And then sadly the show would end, so you didn't get your chance, you know.
Yeah.
So it can be, I'm trying to think, a lot of it is everyday life situations,
yes,
you know, it's supermarket, it's interaction with neighbors, and then exaggerating it. Like I made up a story, I'm sort of making things up or things changing. Like this was a funny example to me of how peculiar comedy is I thought of a thing because I saw somebody had a mug, congratulations on your baby mug. And I just thought, I said to my husband, I said, I don't know why I had such an urge to smash it. Because it made me laugh to think, what a horrible person that would be. And that made me laugh. And then I think he said something and I said, oh, I really want to smash it. And he said, what if you smashed it? And then and then the baby had died. And I went, oh, my God, that's hilarious. That's so terrible. So she'd be really upset because she had a new baby mug, but the baby was dead. And, of course, it didn't work at all because a dead baby is too sad.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I don't want a shock. I want a laugh.
Yes.
And so I thought, no, I'm getting the wrong reaction. I don't want to shock you. I want you, you might be shocked, but I want you to be laughing at the same time. And so I thought, no, it's just not working. And then I suddenly thought, I was bringing a parcel in for my neighbor next door who I get on with really well. And I suddenly thought, oh, what if I broke something? A dog. It's a photo of a dog. It's not a baby, a mug about a baby. What I break is a photo of a dog that died.
Yeah.
And that is perfectly acceptable.
That's perfect.
So it's funny, you know, and I just left that aside. I left it for maybe 6 months and then just something else. I'm a great believer in the subconscious working things through. And it just hit me like, oh, the dog. Yes, make it a dog. And that, people don't mind laughing at a dead dog.
No. That's brilliant. I once saw you very early on warm up at a recording, do the warm-up for Have I Got News For You? Do you think there's a difference between a warm-up gig or hosting a gig than actually performing a full show?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I did a lot of warm-up, which I was very grateful for because it was good, you know, it was good work to get because it was often midweek when there wasn't other gigs.
Yeah.
But I did sitcoms. The first one I did was Graham Norton because he didn't want a man.
Right.
And the producer knew me and said, well, there is a woman. And Graham and I were already friends.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, God, I'd love Joe to do it. And it was learning that you're not that important. You are more important if you're hosting a comedy show. You have more status. I think that's the thing. You have to be able to sacrifice your status if you're doing TV warm-up. You have to be hugely thick-skinned because you've got to keep going out there, keep talking to them, keep them entertained. And as soon as the stage manager goes, okay, running up to record, you just stop talking and get out of the way.
Yeah.
And I know some comics can't do it because their ego couldn't take it. Whereas my ego got pleasure from doing the job well.
Very much so.
And then I would get more work. And I do remember an older comic saying to me, be careful, you can do too much warm-up. And suddenly I realized, it was after years of doing warm-up, I realized what they meant. I went, yeah. Oh, I've become too much of a warm-up. I feel second rate. I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
And I stopped. I still do Have I Got News For You because basically it's such a delight to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also I just do 10 minutes at the top and the audience is great. I have a lot of fun. And then I don't have to do that hanging around. And it's not the hanging around I mind. It's the feeling second rate.
Yeah.
Feeling that you're not worthy of any more. I honestly think it's like waitressing. I used to love waitressing and then I got to a point when I've done this too much. I am a horrible waitress. I resent people. And I thought with warm up, I thought, do you know what? I've started not to enjoy it and I don't want to do it anymore. And I think I stopped it at the right time. And also weirdly, I noticed as my comedy was changing, getting more personal and more attitude-y, more full of, I think this, I think that, fuck this, fuck that.
Yeah.
That's not suitable for a warm-up.
No.
You know, a warm-up has to be more general, nicer, like I could do the chat bit of it, but if any I have to go into material, like in my head I was going, oh, that's not suitable, you can't do the dead dog. You know, it was like, my comedy everybody's too hard now, you know, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, that's fascinating because I've seen so many compares. I've seen so many comedians do the full act, and that was an excellent answer. I wanted to come on to your first Edinburgh Festival.
Mm.
What was your experience with that? How did you cope? Did you have a full show? Were you in? What was the experience like of that?
Well, for me, unlike now, I think, I mean, I'd been doing stand-up, I think, 7 years before yeah. I did my first show. And I only did it because I was working at So Television, Graham yeah. Norton's company. I was a writer on his show. And they said, oh, we're thinking that we might like to take shows up to Edinburgh. You should do a show, Joe. And I was like, oh, could I do an hour? It seemed insane to do an hour. You know, that anyone would listen to me for an hour seemed, wow, crazy. So then it was a case of putting every single bit of material I had and going, oh, that's 58 minutes. I think that's going to be okay. And then sort of putting it into a show. And it was one of those where for a first show, I think it was a good show, but it was, are you really strong enough, interesting enough to hold people for an hour? Looking back, I don't think I was, but everybody has to do a first show,
yeah,
you know. That's why I always think really in Edinburgh, they should have different price scales, you know,
right.
Because I'd be on this at the same price as somebody who had done three, you know, solo shows. So their show is going to be better. It's good. They know what they're doing. I'm still, cause you've got to learn the rhythm of an hour.
Yeah.
That takes a while to learn.
Yeah.
Now an hour doesn't seem long because I know how an hour should feel and where the ups and downs are. And I think there were times if it was hard where I'd be going, oh my God, this is hard now. But I don't think I had bad shows and I don't remember that. And also it sold quite well for a first Edinburgh, I remember, because people tell you, you know, it was Phil, God, what was his name? Oh, that's terrible. Not Phil. Ed Smith. Ed
oh, yes.
Smith.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Ed saying for a first Edinburgh, he kept telling me, this is really good. I was like, is it? And he went, there's 70 people in there. That's really good. I was like, oh, okay. Then, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect. I didn't come up with any preconceptions or even any plan. Like I know now people are all about Edinburgh's a big plan and they, you know, they've got to get stuff out of it. I was just like, if I feel I've earned the right to do an hour and it's okay, and I don't hate myself and people don't hate me, that seems enough.
Yeah.
You know, for the first hour.
What was the year that you, the first year you went up?
Not sure.
Because you've done a lot of Edinburgh.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It could be 2001.
Right.
Maybe, yeah.
Right. One of my very favourite stories about you, and I'll never forget this, but you might think this is forgettable, but I once saw you with a friend of mine at the Pleasance Courtyard, and it was the Pleasance Late Show, and this would have been 2020 would have been my 15th Edinburgh. I go every year, it's my holiday anyway, and you came on and you compared the show. And just as you started the show, all the lights went out and we were all sitting in the dark. And you carried on performing whilst they tried to sort out the electricity. And I've never forgotten that because you were brilliant that night. You made sure the audience were... nobody could see anything, but all you did was keep going. It was a bit like when the two Ronnies had to do the 20 minutes at the Palladium to keep the thing going. I've never forgotten that.
What room was it?
It was the Pleasance Cabaret Bar. And
it was the Cabaret Bar. Now, I was picturing the Cabaret Bar.
Yeah.
And the lights go out there. It's really dark.
Yeah. The headliner was Gary Delaney, and they got the lights back on when he came on.
Yeah.
And when you walk back on, everybody gave you a standing ovation just for keeping going.
And
I think it's hard enough just to do what you do, but to do it in complete darkness. I'll never forget that, and it was just a wonderful thing to see.
Really nice. But also, that's where that would have only worked because the audience is with you.
Yeah,
that's the brilliant thing about comedy, that audience has gone, well, this is terrible, the lights have gone out, but hey, this is a happening, this is now, let's exactly stay with it, build something together, isn't it? That's what can be amazing about comedy.
I mean the question off that was, have you had any other similar experiences has there anything gone so wildly wrong?
Well, I have had that in a TV studio when it was warming up with Graham. I don't know what it was, some massive technical thing again with lights.
Yeah.
And it was a Christmas show, I remember, because I remember the producer, Jon Magnusson, saying, coming up to me and going, Joe, we'll give them mulled wine and mince pies. You know, like, we don't expect you to just keep going with this, which was really nice, because other people had just gone, well, that's your job. Go out there for another half an hour.
Yeah.
They were going, this could be 45 minutes to an hour. So we don't expect you to do that. And just, you know, just fingers crossed, praying like, oh, please, please, God, let it come on again. And then they did come on. And going, God, if they break down again, I have nothing to say. Nothing left to say to these people. Yeah. But there are, disasters can often work really well.
Yeah.
You know, I've had it with microphones where you then have to shout. I've also had it where, and this is where, like, in a badly run club, I remember. So remember, it was Rob Rouse was comparing it, and he said to me, oh, the mic's really dodgy. And keeps cutting out. And he goes, and I've already done 10 minutes of improv on it. It's not funny anymore. And he was absolutely right. Because then when it went again, and then when I went on, it went. And the audience now is as annoyed as I am. Because they're basically going, this isn't good enough. Why don't the mics work? You know, and that become where it's not fun. It's just irritating. Yeah. And you just go, please, can we have some mics that work?
Yeah.
I'm sure afterwards I will think of disasters.
Well, those are fantastic. I wanted to talk to you a bit more about your writing process, because whenever I see you, you always manage to have new material, which is an amazing thing. I mean, a friend of mine always... if a friend of mine comes along with me, he always says, I've heard this before. And I don't mind it, because it's all in the style of the delivery or the way it's said or whatever. But to have the amount of new material that you do must be different thought processes to write the new material, or how do you go about doing it? Is there a specific way, or?
I mean, a deadline is great, I think.
Yeah.
That's why when up until sort of May this year, there was still the possibility that there would be an Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
So I kept writing.
Right.
As soon as it was cancelled, I stopped.
That was it.
It was just that urgency. I couldn't muster it. But then it became different, because I thought, oh, I'd like to start filming things online. So then I started to think, oh, how can I? I'd seen a couple of people had done little bits and bobs, you know, just like that you could film it on your phone and do it an iMovie and put it up. So then I started thinking, oh, I want to do. That's when I started thinking, oh, I'll do those things about Facebook. And I would write down a few and then go, oh, I've got enough things. Got four lines now, that's enough for a little sketch. And so I started thinking about what I could do that wasn't live gigs work, and that became very interesting, because my brain was doing something different, I think. But normally with the writing, it's thinking like a thing today that came up again, it's conversation. And I'd put up a thing on Twitter about, it just came into my head, about the Queen's speech. How could the Queen do a speech to uplift the nation hasn't she sort of lost the right because we basically know her son is a paedophile? I had that as a sort of conversation with my husband. That's a serious conversation. So then I put it up, you know, and I said, oh, I don't want to piss off any royalists, but don't you think, you know, it's a bit, you know, tricky to do the speech when we all know your son's a pedo. And then people, you know, quite a lot of royalists and unfortunately loyalists up here in, you know, up in Scotland were, you know, very offended, took me to task and were like, yeah, but she didn't do it. And I'm like, no, but she's, you know, the establishment and it's establishment protecting a criminal. So it was sort of serious, but funny. And then I was thinking, also, he's not trying to clear his name, which says to me he's a paedophile. And then this isn't a routine yet, but I was thinking, I think this is a routine.
If you're a paedophile,
you'll go, I'm not fucking not. Look, I'll prove it. What do I have to do? Do I have to go to the police station? I'll go. Where do I go? America. I'll go. I'll do it. But he hasn't, has he? He's gone, all right, mummy, I'll stay inside and not talk to anyone, which makes me think he's a pedo. So there was just sort of something in that. And it's often that sort of, there's a seriousness to that, but the very fact that there's a debate to be had makes you think, oh, there's something funny there. And I think it's a sensible thought as well. But I know that people will think it's outrageous to say, because your son's a pedo. That's just funny. No. And so sometimes it is things that I might think of, oh, things that I question, I suppose. You go, oh, is there something in that? Yes, that is interesting. Or again, the observations like here, looking at my bedside table and looking at the books. And then I thought of the thing about, oh, what are my husband's books and what are my books, you know? And so then I thought, what would be the funniest books for the bloke side? And I did the joke and it's serial killers. God, I can't remember what it was. I think it was mafia, serial killers. And God, I can't remember what it was now. There was three anyway. And so I said, I don't know what it is with them, what weirdos, psychopaths, you know. It's like they want to shoot something into you. The pornography was the other one. Could be spunk, could be a bullet. You know, but again, that was looking at the pile, thinking, it's often thinking, oh, is that interesting? And sometimes it's more clinical in that you go, what's the funny word? What's the funny number? Like I had a routine about my friend who's very confident in herself based on a real, you know, kind of a real friend and saying that we couldn't get a table at the restaurant. And I said, oh, we'll just go. And she went, no, I'll use my weapons. And she goes up thinking that she's being all charming and that, you know, nobody can resist her because she's so hot. And she comes back and she goes, I've sorted it. We've got a table. And I went, we've got a table in 2 hours. And I didn't get enough. And I thought, is 2 hours? I don't know if that's funny enough. I don't think 2 hours. And then it came out, 2 weeks next Tuesday. That's funny. 2 weeks next Tuesday.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
And sometimes also, do you know what? I think it's always worth sitting down with a notepad and just trying to write something.
Yeah.
Even if nothing really comes, because I think your brain is working. Or sometimes, I mean, I keep all my notepads. Sometimes I'll look at them from years ago and I'll go, oh, that is a good routine.
Yeah.
I could do that better now.
Yeah.
Or I could add to that now. And also, I think it's just the muscle that's making your comedy muscle work. And that's why sometimes on stage, I've had a joke come out fully formed and I don't know where it came from. And that's just, I call it like a state of grace. Weirdly, it's like sort of religious. It's like, oh my God, I was just given that joke in my head because my brain has been working on jokes.
That's fascinating.
That joke. The one that came out was doing a thing about not wanting to stay at my mother-in-law's, her criticizing me when she comes to me and she go, oh, is that the way you do the tea? And she does do this sort of thing. Is that the way you do the tea? Oh, I don't think Stuart likes it like that. Well, I do it the way he likes it. Oh, is that the way you do the toast? Oh, I don't think Stuart likes it like that. Well, I do it the way he likes it. And I go, oh, Stuart also likes a finger up his bum when he's having a blowjob. And that came out fully formed.
Do
And that's like, also MCs will say that, you know, it's because you're not editing. You've got a lot of adrenaline in your brain. So your brain's working really fast.
Yeah.
And that's why sometimes things you can write on stage, because it all, I look at it like channels in your brain, and they're all open and they're just firing out. And then similarly, other, and there are certain rooms like Always Be Comedy.
Yes.
That to me is a room where all my channels are open.
Yeah.
I just know it. When I go on that stage, I know I can riff. I know I can try something new because my brain is just in a really good place and I'll find the right words. Whereas other times you go into the channels, I look at it as like putting your hand in to pick, get something out, and the door's shut and you just can't get in there.
Yeah.
And then I go, right, I'm going to have to just do the stuff I've got. For whatever reason, the doors are shut. You know, and so that's why you need material. That's why you can't rely on, oh, let's just mess about, because sometimes the messing about isn't there. It's bizarre.
Do you use this approach if you're writing for other comedians, or do you specifically look at the way they work? Or because did you write for I presume you
yes with Graham it was look at his in, yeah, yeah his intonation yeah. is very strong, his speech pattern yeah. and what he's interested in, you know, you'd yeah. know, you'd kind of know what he'd be interested in, and also what his attitude would yeah. be yeah. and you hear it in his voice and his little, you know, little ticks he's got, like you'll go, well, in fairness, and we'd always put in fairness yeah, into something yeah, you know. Yeah. That's the way he sort of phrases, sets things up. Things,
yes,
you know,
you
have to have little settings, and that would be, yeah. And so I think because he gave you such a strong lead that the jokes felt very Graham-like.
Yes, yeah, yeah. He is like that, isn't he? It's his personality that's winning through, and if you've got a very good joke writer for him,
it's almost like an impression, doing an impression. Like sometimes I can't get a joke quite right, I think of a comic that I really like, and I think, like, there's an American comic, Wanda Sykes, and she's got a very, very direct but fun delivery, I think. So I think, right, stop messing about, try it as Wanda, and often that can make you go, all right, that's the way it should work. Yeah, like if I can't get it myself, I'm not quite sure of it. Well, go with someone who's got a really strong way of doing something, and then it kind of can bring you back to you, weirdly.
That's brilliant. I believe you've got a radio show, is that right?
Well, there's a radio show, I don't know what one you mean. There's a radio BBC Scotland show.
You've got a BBC Scotland show, is that right or not?
No, there's one that I'm on quite a lot.
That's what I know.
And I mean, I've had several Radio 4 series, and I've had a special, you know, where you do half an hour of stand up. I don't think I've got anything in the offing at the moment.
There's nothing coming that up, way. Okay, let's move on. Who are your favourite comedians, past and present? Do you have any? Have you?
Sometimes it's routines that I really like, you know, or jokes. I mean, when I was first starting, I got that Woody Allen, the nightclub years, and studied that, because it's great routines. And that was amazing to me, how things were a story and they had beginning, middle, ends. They're really well constructed. And there's lovely descriptions in them of any characters that come in as well, whoever he's talking about, great use of language. But as I say, like, as a kid, it was Dave Allen. Then it was seeing Jack D.
Yeah.
I love his attitude.
Yeah.
And he's also a lot more... he's a lot more expressive than people think. He actually acts out a lot.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you think he's kind of deadpan, but he does a lot, you know. And I always remember with him, this was a routine from years ago, and thinking, wow, what an amazing thing. And he does a whole routine about going to a craft fair. And you know that routine?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And it's he pays 50p to go in. So he thinks, normal shops are free, so this must be much better. And it's just the anger he goes round that with, and the scathing. I think he says something like, "Oh, the fudge fairy? Oh, £5? How do you do it?" And then there's he goes, "Oh, the shell wizard. He was there, that bastard." It was just, there's such great attitude, and I absolutely loved him, his routines. I also remember the one about, you know, his dad doing DIY.
Oh, that was
hilarious. Yeah. And it's this great attitude.
Yeah.
And then, and things that people were liking. I think it was a live show. Must have been after, was it Olympics or something? Where, and he's going to a parade, and he goes, "Oh, we'll put the, have a loser's parade." Like, parade the fucking losers around you, fucking lost. And it was just so ungracious. I loved that. And then Wanda Sykes, who I mentioned, what joke writing. And the way I liked, although I don't do that much topical, because I find politics often makes me too angry. But she had, I remember doing a great routine about budgeting and who they should ask. They should ask a single mother about budgeting. And it was all about coupons. And you could, you know, you could get this from Iraq and with these coupons from, you know, Woolworths and all of this. And it was just a really great, you know, what they call high status, low status mix.
Yeah.
And I thought she was great. I had thought Ellen DeGeneres was really good when I sort of came across her years and years ago. And at the moment, there's quite a lot of people who, Mickey Flanagan was great when he was gigging.
Yeah.
Just, you just go, wow, the confidence, just the,
that's it with him.
Just the, like, oh, what a geezer. You know, just lovely to be in his company. Fun.
Yeah.
Just fun guy you would just want to go out with. Then there's people who I enjoy their brain. Eleanor Tiernan, I like her brain.
Yeah.
Does funny things that I'm not expecting. And she's very unlike me, I think, as well. Although we might have a similar attitude to things or her comedy, I'm like, oh, I love that. That's great. So sometimes it's just people's routine or their manner. Like the other night when I did a gig with James from Always Be, and I don't even know this guy. I think he's called Jacob Hawley.
Yeah.
But I don't know him.
He's just, and I just thought,
I like your manner.
Yeah.
Got a nice manner that's kind of vague, like he's not trying to be funny.
Mm.
And I really liked that. It was like the jokes were accidents. And I really like that. Sean Walsh is a big favourite.
Another great observationalist like you, I think.
And again, he's got the angry observation.
Yeah.
Sean Locke, I really like because he'll say things that, you know, you just go, nobody's going to like that, Sean. And it really makes me laugh. But he also has, I think he did a routine. It was when all the Hollywood actresses wore black to the Oscars in a Me Too thing. And he said, who knew black was the color of rape? And I mostly laughed because the audience were like, what a thing to say. But he's also got just really, really strong routines.
Yeah.
Routine he does about swearing, about cooking shows. Why are they allowed to swear? It should be on Grand Designs. You know, the guy's going, it's nearly winter. I haven't got the fucking roof on. And that's just a beautiful observation, isn't it? Just gorgeous.
Well,
yeah.
The reason I asked the question is that in my blog, I've got a section called The Ones That Got Away. And there's 25 comedians who I either won't be able to see or haven't yet seen.
Right.
And Dave Allen was about number three. So I'm with you. I absolutely loved Dave Allen and all the other observationalists that you've mentioned. Thank you so much for that.
And isn't it the classiness of Dave Allen as well?
Oh, he was just magic.
He's classy. Like, that's the thing you think about. Some of the TV that comics do now, you go, Dave Allen's not doing that.
Yeah.
You know, you just go, well, I'm sorry. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah. He was superb. I almost had a chance to go and see him in London on his last tour, and I couldn't go, and I was gutted. But having seen a lot of comics...
Yeah.
Like me, do you go and see other comedians as a member of the audience, or do you tend not to, or?
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. I find it difficult in Edinburgh, particularly.
Yeah.
Because I'm very antsy. I find it quite hard to get swept along. I'm looking at it more clinically most of the time. And I also, I'll kind of see 10 minutes and go, all right, I get it. I see what your thing is.
Yeah.
And that's enough for me.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a show that's more serious, I might like it. Similarly, I hate it if it's a show where I go, this is just stand-up, but you're trying to make it more than that.
I know exactly what you
mean. By putting on a bit of fucking sadness. Oh, please, just make me laugh. I had some women come up to me, and they were younger women, because I thought, oh, all the youngsters seem to like the boo-hoo comedy. And these young girls came up to me at my show, and they went, oh, thank fuck, you didn't talk about your men. I just really wanted to laugh.
I had a go at doing what you do fantastically well once at the Edinburgh Fringe. I thought to myself, if I'm going to watch them all, I might as well have a go and get it out of my system.
Yes.
And it was the Free Fringe. I know the chap who runs the Free Fringe. And he said, you're going to be on stage at a gong show, which is an old folks gong show, on a Monday afternoon in the Haymarket. So I walked out and I wrote this fantastic script about how I used to drive cars and accidentally cause accidents, you know, and all. And I had all this, and I read it to him, and he said, this is fantastic. And I walked out, and the opening line I had was, ladies and gentlemen, people think I look like Eddie the Eagle Edwards, the ski jumper, which I did. Yeah. But I can't see the resemblance myself. And one old man at the back of the crowd went, ha ha, gonged me off, and that was it. So he let me have another go, and exactly the same thing happened, and I thought, I'll support them forevermore. Never say never again, but...
No, yeah, I wouldn't. I would say never do a gong show.
No.
That's not what you want. You need a bit of love and support at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
But
a nice club where there's lots of new people, and you just... Because honest to God, at first, it's just about saying it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I thought. My first gig, I thought, I want to have not left the building before they call my name. I just want to do it. Say it, because you know you're so much to take in. It takes a few goes to kind of even remotely start thinking about how you're going to sort of perform it
better.
You know, but I think go to a nice club where there's lots of people trying out or are new, and you get a fair start then.
Well, this was, as I say, this was a few years ago. I think I found my niche with being a fantastic audience member.
But,
You know, having said that, let's a question that I wanted to ask you. Of course, 2020 has been a very strange year for everyone and all the rest of it. How do you find online gigs? I know you touched on this before, as opposed to live gigs. And what do you think the future is for comedy? Do you think it'll be more online, or what do you think?
I think as long as I think the general public are still wary of going out. So I do feel even when things were like sort of tier two and things, I know people were having more trouble selling out live gigs because people were wary. So I think it will continue like this, you know, until generally we're vaccinated and the number and the cases are all down.
I
can see this continuing. I mean, also talking to people in events, you know, they're sort of saying we're not thinking, we're sort of talking about October next year before they think you'll be able to get people, you know, in a function room, sitting around a table together, having a dinner and speeches and all that sort of thing. So I think it will go on, yeah.
Because I mean,
the nicer weather, the outside gigs were lovely.
Yeah, they work. Yeah.
It's the willingness of the audience. Because again, you know, so many of us were saying, oh my God, I turned up, it's a bowling green. They're all sitting miles apart from each other. It's freezing cold. They've got their coats on. It'll be a nightmare. But we weren't thinking that. We were going, brilliant. And so was the audience. You know, they were totally with you.
we did the Greenwich Comedy Festival sitting outside, and it was like a thing, and it was Dara O'Brien headlining, and he was so funny because he could see us all freezing, and he just kept going and going and going and going to try and make us laugh and warm us up. It was just brilliant. I think I personally, for me, I do miss live gigs. I do go to a few socially distanced gigs when I can, and live is 100 times better than this. But of course, this is, I always say this is better than nothing, because the way that, I mean, I don't want to plug Always Be Comedy again, but the way that they've done it, where they have the 20 or so who they can chat to, and you get the laughs, that must help the online
community. Oh yeah, I mean, that was, that changed the game, because I do remember early on, I think I did one, well, I did an awards do where I had to film it at home with a green screen. But they wanted stand up, and I was thinking, but I'm just doing this to nothing. This is just awful. And they paid, and I sent it to them, and they were happy. But I was like, oh God, this is terrible. And then I think the first streaming gig, the Stand Comedy Club in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I know it well.
We went there, and they filmed us there. So we were on the stage, and they streamed it out. So the only reaction was the comics in the room. And then I think I must have done a Zoom gig going, all right, this is this new thing, Zoom. But there wasn't a reaction. And then I can't remember, it might have been Sarah Millican's Playground. She did a new material one. That might have been the first one I did.
Yeah,
yeah. Audience. Or it might have been James's. And you were like, oh my God, oh, this is amazing. And you know, and lots of comics who still haven't dipped their toe into the water of doing Zoom gigs. I was saying, no, it's worked. It totally works. You can see some people and you can hear them.
Yeah.
Richard Minnis, who runs, I can't remember what the comedy clubs, they're out usually in Sussex and Kent.
Right.
He did it quite early on, and they were his. He's got a very regular audience. And he did a Zoom gig where you could see and hear, and that were, apart from he had too many people unmuted, and he went, oh, I realise I've got to just have a small amount because somebody was really loudly.
Folk were eating the dinners and all.
Dogs barking, you know, but that was early days of working it out. But it was such a game changer, this thing of getting a front row that you can see them and you can hear them, so you get your rhythm, you get interaction. Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. And so I do love them. And I think they work sort of, they do work differently. Your tone is different because it is more conversational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end of the interview. I cannot thank you enough, because I just think you're one of the best comedians out there. You know how much a laugh I give.
Fantastic laugher. Yeah.
And I just want to thank you so much for your time and wish you a very happy Christmas. Is there anything else you'd like to say? Is there any books to plug? Tours coming up? Anything like that?
I don't think so. The only thing is, you know, follow me on Twitter. Yeah. I've got stuff. It's Joe_Caulfield. I've also done some stuff on Insta. I've got Instagram TV, which is Caulfield J, which is my Instagram as well. So I've got some bits and bobs on there. There's a couple of pieces that are a bit more serious, a bit more dramery. Ooh. And the rest of it is just me, you know, messing about, me dancing.
Being a great comedian, Joe. Come on.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, you know, I love to talk about myself, so this is ideal.
I could talk to you all night. I really could. It's been so nice. Thank you so much for your time.
Have a great Christmas, and hopefully I will see you inside at a comedy club.
Definitely, very soon. Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm just going to...